praise Ahiah family. He's the Most High, holy and eternal, King of all kings, the only true wise and living God, the Almighty. Well, hello again, family. So coming on tonight with our 2B installment in our ongoing MAGA series, which, as you recall, is based on the acronym Make America Great Again. We've been looking really at the whole unfolding of this particular agenda historically, as we're currently seeing unfold in the US currently. By also looking back to understand how Europe became white.
Please don't forget to like, share, and by all means comment on our videos. Subscribe to our channel as well.
So the unofficial title of our series is How Europe Became White, Make America Great Again. So we still have our sights trained on the US, and of course we're examining this history through the artifact that we were looking at, namely this painting, which, as you recall, we have said was painted by a anonymous Flemish painter. And as you can see, the historians have said that it was painted in the mid-16th century. But I actually submit to you that it really is rather late for the painting of this picture, for reasons that we're going to come on to describe, because really by the mid-16th century, there were really no longer any black people really in Portugal in the kind of volumes of which we currently see here. So we're going to look at all of this historically to understand the unfolding of historical events, really, around how this history unfolded. And we're looking at 1492 specifically, because that year, as we've said, really marked the culmination of a number of ongoing agendas to really, to finalise the, I can only say, pushing out or ridding of our people, well, out of Spain and Portugal particularly, because by then the other European nations had long completed their expulsions of Yashralite peoples. So we're going to come on to relook at this. So the actual title for tonight's video, which, as you recall, is part of our part two in our ongoing series, which we had entitled Blacks in Portugal. So this 2B segment is actually called A Hidden History, The Casting of the Lot. So the full title is actually 1492, The Past, Present, Part 2B, A Hidden History, The Casting of the Lot. In our ongoing MAGA series, which, as you recall, is looking essentially at how Europe became white, against the Make America Great Again agenda we're currently seeing unfold in the US as we currently speak. The fact we're even discussing this history in this context at all. So it really does testify to the importance of history. And as I've said, you ignore history at your peril. Because from 1492 to here we are today, in 2025, over 300 years later, and we're still looking at this history, a strategy the Bible calls the casting of the lot, which we're going to come on to look at in this video. So I'm just showing the opening reading for this particular video, which of course is taken from Psalms 94, verse 20, which says, "Shall the throne of iniquity have fellowship with thee, which bringeth mischief by a law? They gather themselves together against the soul of the righteous and condemn the innocent blood. But the Lord is my defense, and my God is the rock of my refuge. And he shall bring upon them their own iniquity, and shall cut them off in their own wickedness. Yea, the Lord our God shall cut them off." So we're going to look really at, well, how the law has been applied to legitimize, if you will, the execution of these agendas historically against brown and Yashuite peoples within these lands. Because if you recall, even the initial law was given initially to the kings of Spain and Portugal to initiate the slave trade, was actually a papal law, so supposedly religious law, to add another dimension as well to the morality, if you will, around how the explorers or colonizers were really encouraged to see themselves by higher authorities within their nation as well, who legitimized that whole mindset. If you recall the actual laws, and we've looked at this extensively, in fact, they're published as podcasts on our SoundCloud channel and also on our website. They're not actually published as videos specifically for YouTube, because we do have a range of mediums by which we do actually publish content. So I would really encourage you to go onto our website, really have a look at some of the other avenues and content we also do publish really around similar themes as well, historically. But we've dealt with this whole history specifically around the actual papal laws in a couple of podcasts that are published on our SoundCloud channel, which is called Who is the True Saint Nicholas? Which is broken down into two parts. Part one deals with the making of a legend, and part two is then called Celebrating Discovery, or the Law of Discovery. It's looking at the whole context, really, of the unfolding or the passage of those papal laws in the context of Nicholas, Pope Nicholas V, who is aka Father Christmas. To really explain to you, really, also one of the origins, really, of the Christmas festival as actually being a commemoration of victory over our people, really, in a sense, as well. That's all covered in those podcasts, which you're very welcome to go onto our SoundCloud channel. I'll post a link for the channel in the comment section of this video for ease of finding. But you can also access it also if you go to our website as well. It's actually published under our IDR, or our Israel Desperate Report page, which you can actually access from the menu of our website. We're going to look at how law has been used, and how papal or religious law as well has also been harnessed, specifically by the Catholic Church, because you have to recall, essentially, we were taken into captivity via the Catholic Church. They are the institution, the organization through which all of our forefathers, essentially, were taken into captivity as well, through that construct. And you could say, essentially, as we now know, that even by Yahuwah's holy laws, in view of the actual covenant he made with our forefathers, that many of these actual laws, when actually constructed in this way, can be binding or legitimate on all their subsequent descendants as well. So essentially, you could even say that to a very great extent, we are still ultimately under the auspices of this law. And the reason I say that is because the actual law that mandated the initiation and execution of the slave trade is still on the papal statute books. In fact, it's not only on the papal statute books, it's also on the global legal books as well. Because the law of discovery specifically, which was deployed under a law called Intra Catera, which, would you believe, family, means amongst other things, to show you the arrogance really with which they mandated these things. It's what Intra Catera actually means, amongst other matters. Yes, but that particular law, which was actually passed in 1493, which is often called the Doctrine of Discovery, was actually invoked in 2005 successfully in a case by Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg to actually win a case against the Oneida Nations of New York. So the actual case is Oneida Nations of New York versus the city of Sherrill. So if that law, which is called Intra Catera, which legitimized the law of discovery, is still legal precedent and can be invoked in a court, then essentially the laws that mandate that Israel is still in captivity are still equally in force. I mean, whether you agree that they're being executed or not is another matter, but the laws anyway mandating that that is the case are still very, very much in force. So I'd like to look really tonight, really at the essence of how law and religious law particularly came in very powerfully into this whole agenda as part of the final push to really push the last of the Ashrawites who were then living in Europe, who by that point had been kettled into Spain and Portugal because the other nations had also pushed them out. So we're going to see really how that all unfolded and understand really what happened to that generation who actually lived through this particular history. And for this reason, tonight's video is also partially a tribute as well to our forefathers and those whose lives were essentially just mashed up by these events as well. And we're going to come on to see equally that there's even a whole dimension of, well, the whole argument around reparations we haven't even begun to consider, because there was a lot of black nobility, really, essentially, in Europe, in these lands, who were then pushed out. Well, essentially, they were fleeced, and their goods and all their wealth then relegated to the crowns, were then divided up amongst the nobles and those who were in league with them. So whenever discussions on reparations are being debated, that aspect is never actually raised. But the actual reparations that would be owing legitimately, if were to be a fair reckoning of them, well, would actually accrue to a much greater value than, well, certainly the figures that are currently being proposed. Anyway, because all they're currently debating, reparating or giving reparations about, is purely the actual labour for the slave trade. And even that, I don't think they could really totally approximate very effectively. Because if you factored in other things like compensation as well, which I think there should be some compensatory aspects, and also, and even, I would also say, even compensation for things like damages as well, for all the reputational, what's the word I'm looking for? But the reputational kind of damage and pejorative kind of slanders for the many of the actual bywords and other things we've had to also endure, it would be a much, much more significant figure. Now, perhaps in actually looking into this history tonight, you'll understand really maybe some of the actual reasons as to some of the, well, some of the actual, what's the word I'm looking for? Reluctance, let's put it that way, by European nations to re-examine this history or to reparate for it. Because really, when you consider in totality, the actual scale of the debt that's actually owed, really, because it is so vast when viewed in that particular light. So tonight's video is in part both a tribute and also a call to action. So as a channel, we really have been looking at the whole history, really, as to how we have come down through time. Well, from the very beginnings, really, from the times of our forefathers, David, well, even from coming out of our first Egypt, through to Israel going through her golden age, of course, under the reign of Solomon, and then it all falling apart and being divided into two nations post that. And looking at our history, really, from then until the present day, to see how we come to find ourselves, what we come to find ourselves today, really. And really, you can see it's been nothing other than the hand of God that there still are any people in the earth today who are brown Israel. And we see how well God had to hide us, even from ourselves, that many of us historically forgot our own identity. Because there have been many systematic attempts to remove us, really, not only from being a nation, but from being really a people any at all. But we come to really understand now that Yahuwah really does have his finger on something. Now, Deuteronomy 28, verse 68 tells us that, if you recall, that under the ultimate curse of Israel's covenant, she'd go into a second Egypt, but this time by ship. So as we can see quite clearly here, it's saying that Israel is currently, well, essentially in her second Egypt in that case, because our forefathers went into a captivity by ships to the New World and also to the Caribbean as well. That's not the bit I want to hone in on here. So it goes on to say, and there you shall be sold unto your enemies for bondmen and bondwomen. The bit I want to focus on is what it's saying here at the end, and no man shall buy you. So what that's actually essentially saying is that no man or no human being or person is coming to save you. But yet that doesn't mean that we are altogether bereft of salvation or deliverance, because we know that you have said that salvation for Israel will be from the Lord her God. Now, the Bible says this in several places, including Isaiah 45:17 and 1 Samuel 17:47. But a particular example of this that I like actually comes from the book of Gad the seer. Now, those who are familiar with Repairers of the Breach will be aware that for us, the book of Gad the seer is a canonical or accepted biblical book. So we do actually read that book and study it quite extensively. And of course, the Bible itself also gives provenance for accepting the book of Gad the seer as well as a viable biblical book. And there are several instances in the Old Testament in which the book of Gad the seer is cited, including notably in 1 Chronicles 29:29, where it's saying, "Now the acts of King David, first and last, indeed they are written in the book of Samuel the seer, in the book of Nathan the prophet, and in the book of Gad the seer." So, as I was saying, I particularly like the account that Gad gives of this. So in the book of Gad the seer, chapter 7, verse 12, it reads, so here Yahuwah is actually, well, rebuking David somewhat for David's sin in counting the people. And that actual account is also covered in the Bible in 2 Samuel chapter 24. And if you recall in that very chapter, it is actually the prophet Gad that brings a word of the Lord to David to reprimand him for this sin in counting the people. So the book of Gad the seer, chapter 7, verses 12 to 13, reads as follows. So here Yahuwah is saying, thus said the Lord, I am the king of Israel, and I am their portion. I am their avenger, I am their fortress and might. And you know that it is not with a sword or a spear that I will save, and not with a man of valiance that draws a sword. For this is the portion of the heathens that stand on their might and many warriors. But you are not like that, for I am a lone warrior, and there is no one with me. Why would you do this evil to number your people? So, you can see here that what Yahuwah is actually saying, that he is actually the salvation of his people, Israel. You'll see that Yahuwah is actually saying there that Israel's deliverance will be by the Lord her God. So if our deliverance will be by the Lord our God, wouldn't we do well to return fully to that God in spirit and in truth? Because surely, as the Israelites, we've tried everything else. We've tried the political process, and that just led to, well, a dead end and no result. We really have tried by every possible means to find a way forward, but with no real tangible result. So that, I think, is an indicator that if anything, we should really make a determination to return fully and totally to Yahuwah, to the Lord our God, in spirit and in truth. And so for that reason, I'd like to actually proclaim or agree that we establish a Wednesday for instance, as a global day, internationally, globally as a people, to commit to our doing a day of fasting on that day until 3 p.m. on that day, to really begin to do the things that Yoga is requiring of us, and also to begin to really begin to cry out to him. Because he's promised to pour upon Israel a spirit of supplication and graces in the latter days. And so I want to actually agree that we actually maintain that particular day as a day when we really come together as a people, wherever we are globally, to really commit to doing that day of fasting for our nation, for our peoples, everywhere. Because as we can see, and as Yahuwah has told us in Deuteronomy 28:68, it doesn't stop or end until we do what Yahuwah is actually requiring of us. And what Yahuwah is actually requiring of us is that we return fully to Yahuwah, to the Lord our God. Many of us are doing this in pockets, and a good critical mass of us now have seen the light and are actually making a determination to do this more diligently and fully. And that is certainly is commendable. But I like to proclaim really that we treat Wednesday of each week as a global fast day for Israel, for our people, for brown Israel. To really begin to intercede to Yahuwah collectively, as a collective, about what conditions in our nation, our own individual needs, yes, as well, but really to have some kind of answer around just for all of the things that really are going on. Because as you see, we're going to come on to discuss this casting of the lot. And you can just really see how long this particular strategy has been in force through the days of Mordecai in ancient Babylon. In fact, there was this genocidal mission to remove a people from being a people by various means. And of course, Haman was the first person who actually instigated that, the Amalekite. And then we see really how effectively even the Greeks, when they then colonized our forefathers in what we actually know is about the intertestamentary period. So the intertestamentary period is that 400-year gap we currently have in our Bibles between the book of Malachi and the beginning of the Gospels. So that actual period is when Alexander the Great of Macedon, who was the first to rule over Greece, actually came and invaded Babylon, conquered and killed Darius III, who was then king of Babylon there, and then became the ruler, essentially, of the then-known world at that time from ancient Babylon. And after his decease, of course, his land fell into the hand of Seleucus, one of his generals, and was then ruled under Greek law. Essentially, the Greeks colonized and again effectively tried to execute the same brutality as Haman had unsuccessfully tried to do in Babylon, but this time with better results, because it resulted in a loss of life and the torture as well of our people as well in that particular time. So this has been an age-old agenda that really has come down from antiquity to us into the present day, effectively. And it may seem quite slightly alarming for me to say that, but the history speaks for itself, essentially. And we're currently watching. I can only call it the execution of a playbook. Why? Well, because of all of the things we're currently seeing really in the US, really around the execution of this strategy, are all self-induced. They're all man-made events. I mean, for instance, the actual emptying of the ports as a result of the tariffs. You can see how very, very much the whole economy is being driven down to try to target a specific people as the ultimate result. And we all see it in plain sight. But what I think will be interesting this time is whether we'll see a repetition of what transpired in antiquity, whereby many nations knew fully well what was transpiring, and everybody sat back and watched and gazed obviously very, very much is kind of falling back, really, currently. Now, everyone just sitting, spectating, watching what is currently going on and unfolding in the US around the overall agenda, I can only say, to push that nation back a couple of generations to not only target a people, but in their attempt to try to extend their hegemony or their rule
to make America great again,
which has effectively come to an end. But it's not perhaps without significance
or
coincidence that, or just after we began to embark on this series in looking at this particular period in history in earnest, all these two notable fires happened in the US. One of the antebellum plantation in Nottoway, the Nottoway plantation in Louisiana, which I see was actually on the Mississippi River. So between, I think it's Baton Rouge, I understand, and New Orleans. So right, literally in the seat of, well, where we know that slavery was quite the most deep-seated, really.
And saw some of its worst abuses.
And also there was another fire as well at another similar, it's like not a plantation, but an actual mansion, the Kalorama Mansion in Washington, D.C. It was also built, I think not as early as the Nottoway Plantation, sometime after, but in the same period of slavery. And we also saw a fire there. And that fire was quite mysterious in as much as, I think initially, when the blaze took hold, I understand the fire service went and actually exterminated or extinguished the blaze, tamped everything down, and there was no further fire there or anything. And then 6 hours later, it caught fire again, but this time the fire seriously took hold and burnt through all of the floors of the property. So I believe it was actually essentially gutted, I believe, after that. So I don't know to say whether there is a direct association between our having started to look at these events and turn our sights to this period in history and these incidents, but it seemed to be certainly very, very coincidental. And also, even I myself had a bit of an epiphany, really, around this series of videos as well, which I'll come on to talk about possibly in our final installment on this series, which will be our part three. Now, I did say we would actually come on to look at a commentary from Professor David Olasoga of the University of Manchester, who, as I had said, is Professor of Public History at that particular university. However, I'm not so sure I will be able to publish his commentary here, because I believe he actually made the comment in a BBC production, which I possibly can't incorporate under fair use within my video. So what I may try to do is I'll publish it as a separate video on our channel besides this video, so you can actually look at his commentary and see what he says, what he said. If there's a problem with that, then I may have to take it down completely. I could actually recall what particular series I actually took the actual clip from. Otherwise, I would actually have gone into the BBC archives. I think there's a BBC iPlayer, isn't there? And actually found the specific series and done a link to it. But I just didn't have that time to sit down and do that, unfortunately. And I did actually take the clip some years ago, so I can't now recall where I took it from. I didn't seem to make a note of it for some odd reason, which is quite unusual for me. But anyway, so I haven't forgotten that in the very first episode, I actually showed you this scripture from 2 Ezra 6:9, explaining that it was really the final indicator, essentially, for the unfolding of the history, or the final trigger. And essentially this overall playbook, or these tabernacle systems who manage these agendas, actually look out for as one of the final triggers to then trigger the series of events that we're now seeing the unfolding of. So we're really going to see really how closely the past does really align to, or can inform or tell us so much about our present and the future. And as the adage goes, those who ignore history really do so at their peril, because they can be deemed to repeat this history. And I think particularly we're seeing that re-unfolding now. But who may perhaps be surprised to see that we are currently in the throes of this whole history unfolding and repeating it, or trying to repeat itself. And it won't be successful, but nevertheless, it is making a concerted attempt. This is actually corroborated by scripture in Psalms. So anyway, moving on. So we explained, well, a little in outline, how the Usherites came to be living in Spain and Portugal by the time of the unfolding of this history. So I don't want to get into too much of a detail around it here. So we explained that as a result of the siege of Jerusalem, which resulted in the destruction of both the city and our temple, our second temple, with fire in 70 AD, which the Romans called the conquest of Jerusalem, they didn't allow anyone to remain actually in the land itself. So normally that's quite unusual, because when you normally invade a land in modern times, you invade it and just put it under subjugation. So you make it tributary to you. You make the land have to pay taxes to you or give you some form of return, but normally you leave the people settled in their land. But in this case, that wasn't the case or permitted. So millions of people were literally driven out and driven into Europe, essentially. So that we actually saw, looking at that artifact that we discussed, that by 1492, Israelites had been living in Spain and Portugal for well over 1,600 to 700 years. So they were very well established there. And you do get that impression, even from looking at this particular portrait. Okay, so let's try to pick up speed, because we have been a little bit long in the unfolding of this. So I'd actually try to make this... So this video is a little bit academic, in the sense that I've actually prepared a series of slides, because there were certain key events and thing that I didn't want to forget to tell you in the unfolding of this history. So to make it so I wouldn't forget to make those points, I've actually put them onto slides. So I hope it won't be death by PowerPoint and that you will bear with me. It is quite a high level review of this history. I would really recommend, if you're keen to know more about it, that you do your research as well and look into it for yourself to corroborate what I'm saying. But by way of speed and to just cover it in very high level quite quickly, I prepared a number of slides for you. And also, we're going to still look at that commentary by David Olusoga, which I'll give a summary review of in this particular video, and then I'll try to publish the actual video itself alongside this one as well, if I can do it. And as I say, what may surprise you to know is that many of nations who actually know who we are, and they actually justify part of the way they actually respond or treat Yashrite peoples, well, by this particular attitude. So Jeremiah 50 verse 7 here is saying, all that found them, speaking of Israel, have devoured them. And their adversaries said, we offend not, because they have sinned against the Lord, the habitation of justice, even the Lord, the hope of their fathers. So that has on occasion been the attitude of some nations as to why they have treated Yashrite peoples, brown Yashrite peoples historically, so poorly. But anyway, so we're coming on now to discuss the unfolding of this history. So as I say, we're going to give a breakdown of the actual commentary that David Olusoga gives. And I did actually have a recording of it.
Please don't forget to like, share, and subscribe to our channel also.
But I'm not sure that I will play it in this particular video. So basically, he says in this video that the actual painting captures a moment in time with the balance of military and economic power. With the Europeans and Africans, he's called the brown people in his portrait Africans, encountered one another on terms of relative equality, he's saying here. So he actually says that this actual painting is of Lisbon in the 16th century, so the mid-1500s. So I would actually say that's actually too late. Not intending to dispute a credible historian's dating of it. But I think historically, well, certainly by that time, many of the Asherites would have been fully driven out of those lands. So it wouldn't have had quite the same hue or volume of our people living there by the mid-16th century, in my opinion. So I actually think it's actually earlier, at least earlier than that, to 100 years before. It's about the mid-15th century, in my view. But anyway, he's saying that the actual portrait shows Lisbon in the 16th century at the height of Portugal's trading empire. And it shows the actual part of the city called the King's Fountain, which I think in Portuguese it's called Chafariz del Rei. So he explains that as Portugal's trading empire expanded, people came from all across the empire to Lisbon. And he said that the city was then so diverse, it was believed that 1 in 10 of Lisbon's population were actually Africans at that time. And he says quite accurately, you see them existing at every level of society as well. He said there were the aguaderos, with the actual water carriers. You'll see the people carrying pots on their heads. And even white people as well carrying pots on their heads, mimicking the Africans, I suppose. But so he's saying that you can see the aguaderos, but there were all who were possibly slaves, but there were also white slaves as well at that time. Because of course we're talking about an era when running water within people's houses didn't exist, kind of modern sanitation. So every scrap of water you wanted to use to wash, to cook, to do anything, you had to actually carry from the actual water source. So the actual fountain, or the place they put the actual water, a fountain, they diverted a river, I believe, to actually provide this water source. And they put it down by the port, so they could also service the ships as well that would come in to dock there with all the trade and wares from all across the then empire and trading routes that Portugal then covered or traded with. So anyway, he points out that there are Africans existing at all levels of the society there, and that there are even boatmen ferrying people across the river. You can see even a boatman with a tambourine. So you can see that very, very much, this is very, very much Israel, because we always have been very musical and keen to entertain. That seems not to have changed in all these hundreds of years. He points out also there's a Black Knight of the Order of Santiago. I think they've actually called João Penasco. I think he's actually been identified as being a living, an actual knight who actually lived. And I think it's interesting that the actual Order of Santiago that he fought for was actually one of the orders that was very, very much behind the Spanish Inquisition, which was really lobbying for the removal of his people. And this is, again, goes back to what I've always said about these tabernacle institutions that our people do join, not recognizing or realizing that the ultimate goal of these institutions is really against the interests, even against the lives, of their own people, essentially. And that has always proven to be the case historically. And that isn't really fully appreciated, I guess, because I think, well, possibly the levels at which many of our people join these institutions are kind of very much foundational. So they're perhaps not able to see the full picture. But that nevertheless is the overall goal. Because as I say, as a knight of this order, he would have found himself very, very much on the side of the Catholic Church, pushing this agenda for the extermination, a removal of his own people from Spain and Portugal, essentially. So we really see how much against the interests of our people these institutions actually are. And this has been a constant history that Israel has constantly repeated, even from the times of the intertestamentary period under the Greeks, where many of our forefathers accepted Greek terms and religion and culture. So again, essentially, it was as if they had joined the tabernacle system, and then how that almost resulted in them getting their chief proponent was trying to actually get them delivered from Greek colonization, killed on a number of occasions by their conspiracy against him. And we've looked at this extensively. We always look at this sort of history around about the actual dedication time when we come to celebrate the feast of dedication. And we do have some as well podcasts published on our website as well about dedication and looking at Judas Maccabee, who is actually the hero of that particular feast and who mandated it for our people. But what I found remarkable, so that was actually David Olusoga's commentary. And what I found a bit interesting was that he's sort of grappling a little bit to really explain what he's really seeing. Because as I say, when you think about Portugal today, you don't think of it as ever having been a traditionally African city or a location where Africans or brown people in great numbers had ever resided. So he's at a slight loss to really identify where these people came from and who they are and what they're doing there. So he simply concludes that maybe they're slaves, I don't know. Many of the guys that are actually predicted or shown in this actual image, you can see they weren't in a period of slavery just then, because you even see some of the brown men dallying with some of the white Spanish women as well. So you can see there were marriages, also that were made with, or intermarriages made with Spanish peoples as well in that time. And what's a travesty or what is a tragedy is that in many cases there were mixed offspring that were born into these unions, who then in this period, either by default or intentionally, you can debate, but ends up signing essentially with the Europeans or with the white majority to actually force their own black side out of the land as well. So I thought that was quite tragic, or quite a tragic aspect of this particular history. But anyway, that was David Olusoga's commentary. But what I really noted really in this, looking at this picture, as I say, he does show, as David Olusoga correctly said, well, he said Africans, but we now know that the people shown here were actually Israel, essentially, but existing at every level of society. So that is certainly true. So that's João Penasco, he's been identified to be of the Order of Santiago, a knight, that order. And then you see a wealthy woman here on the right, sitting on her horse. So obviously a woman of means, because as I say, a lot of our people were also quite well off, of course, by that time, having been in the land for well over 1,000 years, they were very well established there. Many had lands, villas, estates, vineyards, all of which they were given 4 months to relinquish and to leave. As we're going to come on to see. And here we see as well that because often we have fed the line that the white people were never slaves, they were always in a better off position than the Africans, but historically that's not at all the case. So you see here both a white woman and a man with no shoes on, essentially implying that they are quite poor and possibly also slaves as well. You see, they're quite well integrated as well with the Europeans. And as usual, there are a number of really problems portrayed in this image. And what did actually strike me was the facelessness, really, with which the artist, depicted many of these people, really, essentially. It could perhaps be the colours, the palette he was painting with. But he's painted everybody very dark. And well, Israelites, historically, have never really all been, even when they aren't intermarried, they've never been all traditionally very, very dark. We are kind of a range of hues, a range of colours. Even Yahuwah said that we are kind of black under the ground. We're kind of all the shades of brown to very, very dark, to some of us a little fair. Or I think in the Igbos, they call them red Igbos, kind of slightly fair, kind of more ruddy in complexion as well. It's not uncustomary for Israelites to be, but we're all painted here anyway, the same kind of hue. And without features. So as I say, it could just be complexities around painting in such dark colours in mid-15th century portraiture. That could have been a challenge for the artist. I'm not so sure. But all the white characters are painted very, very clearly, with very clear, distinct facial features and characteristics. At least you can see a nose, you can see a mouth, you can see the eyes. But when the black characters are painted, even the knight on his horse, you can see that the features are very, very, well, difficult to see if you kind of look more closely at how they painted the knight and even the black noblewoman, just a faceless blob. And this is very, very, well, quite significant, I think, because it shows a slightly dehumanizing aspect to the way in which they were seen. And really, there are a number of problems really in this painting, really around that particular narrative. In fact, the characters are featureless, as I say. And they're kind of shown in a kind of very frivolous kind of way, in my opinion, compared to the whites in the actual image as well. Many of whom are carrying swords or weapons. Although that could just be a characteristic of the age. Perhaps it was customary for people to carry weapons in public spaces every day in that particular period. I'm not so sure. So the black characters have no faces. And I think the actual black characters are depicted quite lively, you can see. So I'm getting up to mischief, unserious, playful. And they were even sure to include a crime scene in this portrait. I think that's quite significant as well, because it's not typical to see scenes of other races, really, also including crimes, really, or committing crimes in portraits. I must confess, I was slightly surprised to recognise many of these narratives, really, I was actually seeing in this portrait. Because many still persist to this day. Often you look back in the past and you're hopeful that, well, that we would have been able to evolve the narrative somewhat. But I suppose it does stand to reason in view of the actual history that then followed on. And also, you see that wherever you see white people in this image, they're huddled together, looking a little bit as though they're under siege. In many cases, pointing at some of the black characters and things that they're doing, actually, as well, in the actual image. But I think it does overall convey how at home the actual brown people that are in this image appear to feel or to be. You can see they were quite well established there. Which leads on to the question, whatever happened to all these people? So let's look at this history. So the strategy of the crafty counsel of the wicked. until the Alhambra Edict was actually the law or the edict that was invoked or created to address this particular problem, which is essentially was the ridding of Spain and Portugal, that were then the last final bastions or countries which still had Yashuaite peoples or populations within them in significant numbers at that time in all of Europe, because by that time the other European nations had already addressed their particular issue or problem, and as a result they've been driven into Spain and Portugal, which is the last standing European area where people could have fled to. So the Alhambra Edict actually initiated the Inquisitions, and the Inquisitions went on for over 350 years and were only repealed, or the laws actually governing or around the Inquisitions were only repealed as late as 1968. So even within living memory of us. So we're going to come on to see what the Alhambra, a little what the Alhambra Edict said. So this period also initiated a period that came to be known as the Enlightenment or the Renaissance. So it was known as the Enlightenment in Britain and the Renaissance in France. So we discuss this a little in our first part one to explain how it initiated a period of iconoclasm, or the removal of black contributions, black artifacts, sculptures, imagery, portraiture, anything that conveyed black presence or domination or rule within Europe prior to that period. Because very, very much the Yashuaites or brown people had been ruling essentially and had been in charge of many things and within many of the European nations, or in medieval times and before that. So about the time that this edict was passed, luck would so have it, or it would just so be, the plague also broke out. And you'll never guess who was then accused of having the highest propensity to actually transmit the plague. You guessed it. So the Inquisitions lasted for 350 years. So what was actually the result of the passage of the Alhambra Edict? Well, to name just a few of the actual events that then began to unfold. On June the 6th, 1391, rioters killed an estimated 4,000 Jews. Most of those who survived converted. So the actual ones who converted were called conversos, or left the city. So that by the time of the expulsion in 1492, there were few Jews remaining in Seville to be exiled. So King Henry III, who was then the king of Spain, redistributed their property to various Christian nobles. So as I've said, these events always do are accompanied by an attempt to remove wealth, resources, benefits gained, and to assign them to others. So the murderous rioting in Seville spread to other parts of Spain, to Castile, to Aragon, and Catalonia, which is in the Barcelona region, followed by the island of Mallorca, and continued for 3 months. But there was a great level of support for the Inquisition as well at that time. So you're seeing here on the right, really, the actual garb that, I mean, this particular style of dress has actually come from the Inquisitions and would be what many of our forefathers would have been made to wear. In many cases, they actually put a letter or some kind of commentary or something to denote on the actual hat, on this conical hat, denoting the actual sin that the person who is wearing it is actually guilty of. As well. Now, I don't know that the actual robes themselves actually started from the Inquisition. I think those came to be worn subsequently. They're called, the actual garments are called corporates. I'm not quite sure how you pronounce it. C-O-P-I-R-A-T-E-S is how it's spelled. Co-pirates? Corporates? But it's meant to be the kind of dress of penitent, people who are penitent for their sins or in a repentant state for their sins. So I don't believe that they actually wore the actual robe in the Inquisition. They wore a tunic. Historically is what I believe. But this actual wearing of the actual robe you're seeing here came to be worn subsequent to that whole, the Inquisitions. And it's still worn to this day in some parts of Spain as part of the of their celebrations and commemorations and festivals. I think around about Easter, I think, is one of the times they actually may wear this particular garment in some places. Not all, it's not a universal practice throughout Spain, but there are some organizations and brotherhoods that do adopt this style of dressing in some regions. Now, I'm aware that the Spanish do have some sensitivities around our pointing out the fact that this style of dressing, for want of a better way to call it, has also been adopted by a certain extremist group in the US to deal with, well, essentially the same people, because many of the, well, the Jews that were actually had to wear these conical hats as part of their undergoing or going through the Inquisitions were also Jews. So yes, I certainly do accept the fact that anyone Spanish seeing this video will say, well, no, those garments have no association with a certain extremist organization. They denote repentance and penitence. So I do see that, but I think the actual alignment to the fact that it originated from this particular history, which was then used to perpetrate the same result against the same set of people, but now living in another land, is not without significance. But anyway, so the Alhambra Edict, or the Alhambra Decree, what did it say? So the Alhambra Decree, also known as the Edict of Expulsion, or the Alhambra Edict. So in Spanish it's known as the Decreto de la Alhambra Edicto de Granada. So this edict was issued on the 31st of March 1492 by the joint Catholic monarchs of Spain, Isabella I of Castile and Ferdinand II of Aragon. So it ordered the expulsion of practicing Jews from the crowns of Castile and Aragon, essentially the whole land of Spain, and its territories and possessions by the 31st of July of that year. So in terms of some interesting points around this Alhambra decree. So this decree was really spread or launched in Granada on March 31st. Which was based on a draft decree. It was made by this particular gentleman on the left here, Tomas de Torquemada. As you can see, he was a man of the cloth. So just to give a bit of detail around his background, he was a Roman Catholic Dominican friar and first Castilian Grand Inquisitor of the Tribunal of the Holy Office. So essentially, he was a very high-ranking member of the Catholic Church, essentially. So apparently the actual office, the Tribunal of the Holy Office, was, Wikipedia is saying here, a group of ecclesiastical prelates created in 1478. So a prelate is a bishop or other high ecclesiastical dignitary. So it's saying that the Tribunal of the Holy Office was presided over by a group of bishops, so Catholic bishops, essentially, to whom I assume that this Tomas de Torquemada would have reported to as first Inquisitor General. But he would have deemed to have been so a high-ranking member of the Catholic clergy, essentially, is what we can see that he was. So you see, again here, an example of how religious law, in a sense, was used as a justification for some of the, for these actions, tortures and cruelties being meted out because many of the actual confessions they secured were tortured out of the victims. So apparently this office, the Tribunal of the Holy Office, which Thomas de Torquemada was Grand Inquisitor, was actually created in 1478 and charged with the ill-defined task of upholding Catholic religious orthodoxy. Within the lands of the newly formed Union of the Crowns of Castile and Aragon. Because before that, apparently, Spain was in two separate domains, Castile and Aragon. So the marriage of Isabella and Ferdinand actually brought the land into one kingdom of Spain. So at that stage, it was still very, very new, newly formed. And this was seen as a way to actually consolidate. Or one of the things they actually did to consolidate the union, apparently, of the crowns. But anyway, so it was dated March the 20th, and it's very interesting and significant that it actually sets out an official position reaffirming that the crown was actually the owner of our people, essentially. So it's saying here, the official position is reaffirmed that only the crown can decide the fate of the Jews, since they are the possession of the monarchs. Is actually what it said. I believe, quote, that she says, they are ours, it said. So, to hear that they are ours. And it also contained many exulting expressions against the Jews as well, because they are accused of making fun of the laws of Christians and considering them idolatrous, because of course the Catholics bowed and made the sign of the cross to a statue of Mary that they would have considered to be idolatry, essentially, which essentially is what it is. But so it mentions the abominable circumstances and of the Jews' perfidy. So in other words, it labels Judaism as leprosy. So, I mean, you couldn't... Maybe the irony is lost on them. They're being equally as rude as they're accusing, or even ruder than they're accusing the actual Jews of being, in saying that they were idolatrous. But anyway, it's saying that it recalls that the Jews, by their own fault, are subject to perpetual servitude, to be slaves and captives. So here we see the actual writing, or what is actually decreed in the actual papal laws as regards that initiated the slave trade as regards the status of brown and Yashurite peoples. And that's taken, incidentally, I've just looked that up on Wikipedia, expulsion of the Jews from Spain. If you want to go and look at that information, you can go online and it is there accessible for all to see for themselves. It may have been updated by perhaps since I actually took this off, because I would actually prepared this now probably a couple of years or so ago. As I say, I have actually held off deliberately putting this particular video out. So what did the Jews do? Because as we've said, by this time, they've been living in Spain for more than 1,700 years. So you can imagine their shock. So the edict, of course, was received by them with despair and disbelief. They were given 4 months to wind up their affairs and were not permitted to take any gold, silver, or precious metal with them. They sought frantically to sell their property and possessions, but the task was virtually impossible in the time allotted. And you can imagine that the accumulated wealth, the communal wealth of generations, including villas, houses and vineyards, orchards, and even grain fields. Because they've been very well established for some time. So that is actually, so on the left is an actual picture of the edict itself, with the signatures of the queens, the king and queen of Spain, who actually signed it off. And of course there's seal also. It looks like it's actually given on the bottom. You see that actually citing from papal religious law that's actually on the papal statute books in saying that the Yashurites, the Jews, were their property and were deemed to be slaves for perpetuity, as far as they are concerned by that edict. And that's part of the reason why I think it's quite detrimental that really that is still on the statute books to this day, and is still being invoked legally in law, as I said, as recently as 2005, to actually successfully defend a case which was won on the basis of that law. And again, if you were to look into that history, you can do that also. The actual legal case is called Oneida Nation of New York versus the City of Sherrill. So the plight of the Jews, I'm trying to speed up. So a contemporary priest, Andres Bernaldez, describes how most of their possessions went for a song, for a pittance. So many of these people were forced with actually parting with a vineyard for the price of a handkerchief, a house for a donkey, a workshop, probably with, complete with all its tools, for a piece of linen or for a loaf of bread. That was actually the state to which these people were actually reduced to in order to divest of their properties within the 4 months allotted. Of course, there wasn't sufficient time or intention for them to be able to do that either. So the whole estates were literally handed over to others. So some people buried their valuables in the hope that they would return later to retrieve them. And King Ferdinand ensured he would reap, of course, from this decree, because he also ordered the Jewish communities to pay the communal taxes due for the next several years, so they would not lose revenue by their departure. Now, there is some conflation really with this history, because, of course, there is another people, the Jewish people, who also claim that they were actually the actual incumbents who actually incurred this history. And while I don't deny that, I'm sure there possibly were Jewish people also in these lands at that time. I don't deny that at all. But what is significant, as you'll see, is the actual outcome for these particular brownish right people, because the actual, or where they ended up, was actually in captivity. So I'm not actually aware, to my knowledge, and maybe if there are any Jewish people who do see my video, they can maybe corroborate from their own history and inform me that they did actually go into a captivity or into slavery as a result of their deportation from Spain and Portugal around this time. But we're going to come on to see this, as I say. But anyway, it's moving on. So then, debts outstanding to Jews were deferred or transferred to the crown. So many of the Jews, some of them were moneylenders or had actually given things in trust to others to be repaid at a subsequent time. So it's saying here that the crown ensured that those debts, the actual repayments of them, accrued to the crown. So then they were faced with the next dilemma, where to run to. So finding a country of asylum, because as I say, they had been kind of kettled in by the other nations in Europe, gradually driving them out until they all really culminated or ended up mainly in Spain and Portugal as a last kind of standing bastion where they could have fled to. But then now, where were they to go to? So it's saying here that some of the things they tried to do to address the dilemma that they were in, so to ensure that their children would have extra protection during the upcoming ordeal, many families quickly married off their children or married off their daughters or sons to try to ally them to some kind of support, hoping they'd be able to remain together at least. But that wasn't to be their fate. But anyway, it says the major problem, however, was finding a country of asylum or where they could run to. So England and France had banished their Jews. So they actually had done this in the 13th and the 14th century, so many hundreds of years before. England had completed this by 1290, apparently. Edward I, who's also known by the nickname Longshanks, is the one who actually signed that edict into law. But after the Black Death of 1348, which wiped out almost a fifth of Europe's population, many German towns had expelled Jews or destroyed their communities, accusing them of actually causing the deaths by poisoning the wells. So in terms of the expulsion from Spain, the expulsion began in the first week of July. So some 120,000 Jews, the majority of whom were from Castile, travel to neighbouring Portugal, where for an extortionate fee, they were granted entrance by the King of Portugal, John II. So King John II promised to actually sponsor ships to take the Jews to wherever they wanted to go. But those who were unable to pay his extortionate entrance fee were sold into slavery. So King John then subsequently changed his mind about sponsoring ships for their safe passage and instead forced them to convert to Catholicism. So in terms of them being sold into slavery, so King John II gave them the choice to either convert or be sold into slavery. So he arrested the children of Jews who refused to convert and sent these children to the Portuguese island of São Tomé, essentially selling them into slavery to work sugar plantations there. But the island was very, very inhospitable, and many of the children actually devoured by large lizards, so likely crocodiles, or died of starvation and neglect. So I've actually looked at this scripture in times past to understand really that merchandise and mystery Babylon is not purely in commodities, as we see. This list contains a list of high-end luxury goods, gold, silver, precious stones, pearls, fine linen, purple, scarlet, fine wood, all manner of vessels of ivory and precious wood and brass, iron and marble and so forth, and then foodstuffs as well, and then even chariots, so supercars, super yachts, sort of luxury items essentially. But underlying this overall trade of Mystery Babylon has always been this merchandise in slaves, so of course being the slaves of our people, and also the souls of men as well. So hence the actual maintenance of supposedly saying by their edicts, by their laws, that the Israelites remain perpetual slaves to essentially the Roman church system is how we're actually taken in, inducted into this system. And there's also a sublical trade as well that also transpires, whereby those who benefit from this system are required to make a trade of their souls for material wealth and prosperity and gain. So this is Mystery Babylon. Let me explain that one of the actual names for Mystery Babylon was actually foretold by the prophet Isaiah, who actually birthed this construct into being through his prophecy. Then we may have Shalal Hashbaz. And we've done many sessions actually looking at this particular prophecy. Meher Shalal Hashbaz, of course, meaning quickly to the spoil, swiftly to the plunder. And that's been really Babylon's whole MO or mode of operation, especially during her time under her fourth iteration in the 4th B system under Idom. I won't cover this history again too much here, really. I'm just citing it so you can see it just very closely aligns to the whole underlying mission. Because that is this little desperate report, we do as we have explained, look at the spiritual dimension really behind what we're seeing in the natural. So just to provide some spiritual context to what we're actually seeing the unfolding of, is why I'm citing Revelation 18 verse 12 here. So looking at some actual literature and books that do actually corroborate the unfolding of these events at the time, we're coming almost to the end now. So this particular account is taken from a book called The Jews and Moors in Spain. So it's saying that the populace being lashed into a relentless fury because of the visitation of the plague. So the king's decree awoke again simultaneously with the reawakening of his greed. He issued an edict which threw even that of Tokmada into the shade. So, of course, the Edict of Tokmada is the Alhambra Edict we just looked at. So it said that all Jewish children below 14 years of age were torn from their parents' arms, dragged into the church, baptized, and those under 3 years of age were given to Christians to receive a Christian education, or in other words, to be raised as slaves. So I'm not aware that this history actually transpired or happened to the Jewish, or people who say they are the Jewish people. I know that they were possibly also in these lands at the same time. I don't dispute or doubt that. It's very, very possible that they were. But I'm not quite sure that the result of what happened to them was the same as what happened to our people. I think the actual fact they were put into slavery and were called the property of the crown does define or explain quite clearly who that particular peoples were. But anyway, and we goes on. Those under 3 years of age were given to Christians to receive a Christian education, or in other words, to be raised as slaves. And those between 3 and 10 years of age were put on board of a ship and conveyed to the newly discovered unwholesome island of St. Thomas, called Ilhas Perdidas, or the Isles of Perdition, which was colonized by Portuguese condemned criminals to fare there as best they could. And those between 10 and 14 years were sold as slaves. I think then indeed the cup of their affliction was full to the brim. So that's the first excerpt. The second excerpt, taken from the facing page, says, such grievous calamities gave way at last and were replaced by the wildest paroxysms of despair. Piercing shrieks of anguish filled the land. Childless and broken-hearted, they now sought to leave the land, but they were told they had forfeited their right, and they were given the choice between baptism and slavery. So this is now talking about what King John did to them when he went into Portugal. Thousands after, enduring all they did, after leaving their beloved Spain and all their wealth and ease, submitted to baptism now in the hope of being reunited with their children. Thousands were sold as slaves, yet prior to their being sold, they were submitted to tortures, cruelties, outrages, too revolting, too repulsive, too heartrending to be here narrated. Terror seized upon the native Portuguese Jews when they helplessly beheld the cruelties to which their Spanish brethren were subjected. They knew they themselves would not escape the wrath of the church much longer, and they thought of flight. And well had it been for them had they made their escape then. That's and just another brief excerpt, so you can see really the in terms of these situations and the horrors really they saw at that time. And that's why I've said really that tonight's video is also partially a tribute to those who lived and endured through this particular period in history, for which there's really been no reckoning really at all. But now you see what Yahuwah is actually saying in Joel 3. You now see the disposition of Yahuwah now returning, but not with the meekness of the Lamb, but with his sword, really, to coming to execute a judgment for these controversies, which is what Joel 3 is actually saying. So the other excerpt, and I don't actually have the provenance for this particular excerpt. I do apologize for that. I did actually see it in something in a video I was actually looking at. And I would actually say to creators, if you're going to actually cite references, it's quite important to write the provenance for them. Perhaps they weren't aware, so I don't have it for this particular excerpt, but it is quite a relevant excerpt, so I would still like to include it here, as it is a valid, certainly corroborates all the history that we are currently narrating. So saying here, the Portuguese that dwelt on this island informed the Netherlanders, so this is now talking about the island of St. Tome and Principe, which, as we've said, was an island to which Spain, Portugal deported many of the brown Jews to. So the island of St. Thomas and Principe is off the west coast of Guinea in Africa. So this is why we're actually saying that this makes it quite clear the actual people being referred to here. Because as we've said, It may well be that there were Jewish people actually living in Spain, Portugal as well, and possibly they did incur the same sorts of injustices around the time of the Inquisitions. But I don't believe that any of them were deported into slavery, at least as far as I I'm aware, perhaps they can corroborate their own history to verify that. But I don't think the historical record either bears that out. So I think this particular incident, and remember, Yehoiada did actually say that this is one of the things that would actually transpire or happen to Israel in the time of her calamity or in the time of the Gentiles as a sign. It would be upon Israel as a sign as well as to who the actual people actually are as well. And that is corroborated in Deuteronomy 28, of course. It's detailing the actual curses of Israel's covenant. So here it's saying the Portuguese that dwelt on this island informed the Netherlanders that few lived above 50 years there. Yet notwithstanding, the great gain tempted them to tarry. Several of them having 200 or 300 Negroes that worked in the sugar mills that John III, King of Portugal, sent a colony thither above 200 years before, whom though the unwholesome air destroyed. So it's saying that he sent about 200 slaves there 200 years before, but the unwholesome air actually destroyed or actually perished because the air apparently was something incommodious about the air in this particular place. Perhaps it was maybe a very, very hot place, and of course working on a sugar plantation, you know, sugar is one of the most grueling crops that was ever given to slaves to harvest. It is really a very, very it's one of the toughest crops in terms of the actual toll it takes on the human body just to even work and harvest a sugarcane field. It's quite a strenuous crop. The worst probably of all crops to actually work with kind of primitive implements as they would have had back in those times. So it's saying that they perished in this particular place. And then it says that the place was not left desolate, for he found new inhabitants. For he sent new inhabitants, essentially, who I think initially settled them in Guinea, which is literally just facing, actually on the actual mainland, just across from where St. Tome and Principe is. So you kind of get an idea in your mind's eye as to the actual place we're actually talking about, the actual island we're actually talking about. It says next in, so they settled in Guinea, and then they were actually sent, after having had some time to acclimatize in Guinea, I think is the point it's trying to make, to the island of St. Tome, that they might be kind of better, kind of acclimatized to the air. So the said king sold off those Jews for slaves that refused to embrace the Roman religion and caused their children to be baptized, from whom, coming thither in great numbers, it says most of the present inhabitants were descended from those people who were sent there as children. And then the third and final excerpt, reading from the top, says, a massacre was generally a prelude to a plunder, as we have seen in various parts of Europe. When banished from England in the reign of Edward, their estates, which were confiscated, brought immense sums to the crown. When Philip Augustus expelled them from France, he confiscated their estates. Yet he soon after recalled this oppressed people to fleece them again. They have almost everywhere paid for liberty to exist. He's quoting here from the Bible. Thy sons and thy daughters shall be given unto another people. Because how exactly has this prophecy been fulfilled in several countries, especially in Spain and Portugal? In the former of those kingdoms, the Council of Toledo decreed that the children of the Jews should be taken from them and educated in the Christian faith. When they were expelled, all under 14 years of age,
were forcibly detained to be baptized. How hard this must have been. So it just gives you a brief flavor, actually documented from the actual records at the time, as to some of the injustices and indignities, really, that these people were made to incur and to suffer. And as I said, does put a completely different complexion on the whole discussion around reparations. Because as we can see, there was nobility also in these countries and nations who's lost, well, everything. Their estates, their wealth was all confiscated and given to others, specifically to the crowns and nobles of those nations, essentially. And it's likely these people, many of whom actually ended up in the New World, never recovered the fortunes of previous times and generations. So it would, if that element was also factored in to the whole discussion of reparations, well, it would make the whole thing. It would, yeah, it put it into a completely different dimension. But I certainly think that any discussion on reparations, but I think really certainly in terms of the actual reparations even paid, I have to say essentially, to those who say they are the Jews, would form a very good benchmark. I think any kind of reparations given to our people should ideally be along the same sorts of lines as their reparations have been since the founding of their supposed state, in another state. In so much as there also needs to be some element of it that is iterative and ongoing in supporting us to get back on our feet as a nation, as a people, and to recover our nation also. So I said at the start of this video that this video was in part a tribute to the generation of our people who were in Spain, Portugal at this time and lived through this history, and who incurred, well, the loss of everything, essentially. Because on top of losing their physical possessions, their homes, many of whom also had vineyards, grain fields, properties, estates, and then, on top of all of that, they lost their children. Because they were separated from their children, many of whom were sent on their own, on ships, on long voyages back to St. Thomas and Principe, the island off the west coast of Guinea in Africa. And these were children. So you can imagine how besides themselves their parents must have been. And then knowing they'd never see them ever again. And then we saw the fate that befell the children, many of whom were eaten by crocodiles, or just died of sheer neglect. Because of course there was no one there to care for them. And then still, on top of having lost their estates, their properties, their wealth, and then losing their families and the children, they were then, in many cases, they were then themselves put into slavery. So they really were the generation on whom, well, the whole Plymouth Rock, really, of the curse of Israel's covenant, really did fall in its totality. And they are to be celebrated because yet, despite all of that, and surviving the Spanish Inquisition, they didn't die. And we today are alive only because somebody made it through. Someone survived all of that. And this all occurred before we even get to the atrocities that were done to our forefathers in the slave trade. And what has been the response from those whose ancestors were on the wrong side of this history? And you do realize, family, don't you, that
that if they had the luxury of time, they would try to say that this history never actually happened and try, well, to erase this history completely and say that it never even occurred. We've already seen a case in point in that respect because we're all aware that Donald Trump ordered the removal of an exhibit of African-American artifacts pertaining to the slave past of African-Americans in the US, calling them woke and anti-American ideology family. This is at the Smithsonian Institute in the US, which, as you know, is not only one of the largest museums in the world, apparently, but one of their key roles is to be a preserver of heritage. It's quite a significant attack on our heritage, because that is, I mean, a slave past is part of our historical heritage as a peoples. I don't think a particularly good response to a difficult or even what some may perceive to be an inconvenient history, if I don't denigrate the memory of my forefathers and those who lived through this history, to say so, is to bury one's head in the sand about it. But if this really is allowed to stand, we can all really see how this is going to go. Because within a short space of time, we'll have people saying that as a people, we are prone to either hallucinations or mental insanity. And then the whole argument will start. Well, we can see how it will go, family. In terms of us being accused of being a people who have a higher propensity than every other race in the world of exaggerating and mental instability. I mean, we see it every day. And this, as I've always said, is part of the reason we're all being encouraged to relinquish our books and our physical libraries and all go digital. Because, of course, we all make the whole process of iconoclasm, part 3.0, much easier for them. So it is still quite important to maintain a physical archive of books if you can, as I've always said. So as I say, I did have an epiphany myself around the making of this particular series of videos, which I'll come on to talk about in the final part 3 of this series. But we can see, and many also have said, that the ancestors really are very much talking. Of course, all the incidents we've seen around the fires at the Antebellum Plantation, the Nottoway Plantation, and also the Kalorama Mansion. And then also, I believe there was a Confederate Museum as well that was also destroyed in that period. And numerous things occurring around that history as well. Just since our start, really, in looking at this history in this series. Well, it was certainly seen to be more than just a coincidence. So yes, so as I said, this video was also intended to be in part a tribute to that generation that lived through this particular history. And they really are to be remembered and to be praised. Because as I say, we are only alive ourselves today because they somehow found a way and found a reason to keep living despite all they suffered.
But were you of the opinion that we Yashralite peoples only started coming to the UK and Europe in significant numbers from 1948? That's not at all the case. We simply returned.
So the story doesn't end there, because of course we know that that did mark the onset of the greatest injustice, really, in terms of what's been done to our people to date, in terms of the actual onset of the slave trade. But even into the modern day, in our final part, we're going to look really at, well, Spain's atonement, really, for this particular period in history as well, because they did quite recently, as we're going to come on to see, 500 years after the fact, then try to make amends, if you will, at least so they said. But we're going to look into that
and look at the actual sort of where those amends actually were directed to as well. So I appreciate this has been, it is quite a difficult history to even listen to. For that reason, I've kept it very high level and have gone through it quite quickly. But it is essential, seminal knowledge and information which all Brangash Right people, particularly those who live in European nations, should be aware, I believe, in my opinion, of this particular history. So we'll come on to discuss the reasons as to why in our final concluding part three, which should be coming out fairly shortly. So let's draw a line under what we've gotten to for today. So we'll come on in our concluding part three to draw all of these threads together as you weave in the point you mentioned about 2 Ezra 6 verse 9, actually providing the final trigger or indicator. We'll illustrate and demonstrate how. And I'm really going to show you really the alignment quite clearly in terms of how I'm saying that 1492, well, is aligning quite closely to the present, more specifically to 2020, particularly. Many things actually transpired in that year, which we're still living in the unfolding of, did align directly to events that emerged in 1492, as we're going to come on to see. So we're going to draw a line under where we've gotten to today for today's episode, which is a little longer than usual. But I think it's fitting that it is, in view of the actual subject matter, to God be the glory. So remember, family, you and I, we are the repairers of the breach. As per Isaiah 58:12, hashtag, we will restore his paths.